It's 12:06. Welcome back to Open Air on the Rhythm and News Service of Jefferson Public Radio, streaming online at ijpr.org. I'm Eric Thiel. Craig Shanks joining me in the control room. We are thrilled to welcome a special guest to the show today. Singer-songwriter Meg Hutchinson is here. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Meg is performing tonight at 7:30 at Brit in a special off-season concert. They are inviting not only Meg up on stage, but all of you as well, if you choose to go out there tonight. They're going to shut the big storm doors and kind of orient everybody in a little bit different configuration and put on a concert on the stage with everybody in more of an intimate setting tonight at 7:30. Information at britfest.org. Meg, I'm always fascinated to meet songwriters who have grown up in a house full of words. And that certainly seems to be your story. I understand both of your parents were writing instructors.
Yeah, they're writers, teachers, and they come from families of also writers, author. You know, my mom's father was in publishing, and my dad's father was historian and old cowboy and wrote a lot about California, actually, and the Old West. And you know, so growing up in my family that felt like that was valued probably more than anything else. We weren't told to go have important jobs and make a lot of money. We were encouraged to, you know, pay attention and try to figure out a new way to say something.
And it's often said now that you're Boston-based, but you actually grew up in pretty rural southwestern Massachusetts, right?
I did. I grew up in the southwest corner, just about as far as you can get without being in New York or Connecticut. And it's a sleepy, sweet little town all winter long, and in the summer it kind of explodes with art and dance and, you know, music and Tanglewood and all these things. I kind of got the best of both worlds, this really quiet little town and then the nice kind of city influence in the summer.
And you once said that that setting had many spaces in between events.
Yeah, especially my family. I mean, I never had a television. I never had internet or anything. And my parents really sheltered us. But to some extent, that was wonderful. I mean, every afternoon was spent out in the woods behind my house, like digging new channels for the stream. And I really found that there was a sense of time, this tremendous expanse of time as a kid that wasn't eaten up by technology. And I've carried that with me now. And I try to get myself back to that. But it's increasingly challenging in our world, I think.
Were you big into poetry and writing when you were younger?
I was just so surrounded by it, so steeped in it, that it wasn't really a conscious thing. But it was, I remember pretty much around 7th, 8th grade writing my first poems. And at that point, feeling like I was getting the right advice from my family. Mm. You know, I remember having this kind of standoff with my school teacher about, I wanted to write a poem about a teardrop with the word elastic in it. And she thought it should be eternal. And I was just really upset about this because she kept crossing out elastic. And I brought it home and I was like, Mom, what do you think? I want to write elastic. She was like, that's brilliant. That's your word. That is a different way to say it. And eternal, you know, whatever. That word's been, you know, overused. And I go back to that lesson over and over in my writing now, even. You know, the elastic versus eternal. Like, come up with a weird way to say it yourself.
Yeah, I was curious whether your parents' obvious love of words has shaped your own songwriting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and in terms of its vocabulary and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the songs still come from the words first, even though the two grow up together. But for me, it's this feeling of, you know, the writers that I admire the most, the songwriters I admire the most are people like Greg Brown, whose songs have layers every time I listen. You know, I've heard some of his records, you know, for 10 years, 15 years, and I still hear something new. So I feel like, for me, that's kind of the measure of a good song.
Meg Hutchinson is my guest live on Open Air here on the Rhythm and News Service of Jefferson Public Radio. In concert tonight, 7:30 in Jacksonville at Brit. Information on tickets at britfest.org. Can we hear a tune?
Sure. I'll kick off with this song, Travel In. And this is a song that I wrote to remind myself that in all of this physical travel we do as songwriters, that there's hopefully another kind of journey that I'm not forgetting to be on. And so I remind myself when I'm, you know, stuck somewhere on the tarmac missing a gig, and instead of stressing out going, hey, you know, what's the inner work I want to be doing in my life that kind of keeps the artist alive? So it's called Traveling. Lake Michigan, Lake Erie, a thatchwork of fields, a flock of white birds tossed into the sky. I live in corners of the night, checking in and checking out, and then I fly. States stacked up on states, all pressed against the highway, whole country working hard to look the same. They call it an illness, that miracle spring, when I leapt out of my flesh and became one with everything. Can I fit my coat to yours? And can we turn and turn and turn? Can I stitch your sadness to the wind and let it go? Will you build a little cabin on your little piece of land? Will you curve your body against mine and let it rest? I learned the oneness of alone. I learned to call this motion home. Travel in, travel deep. Travel in, travel deep. Days stacked upon days, thunder in the winter, lightning flashing through the falling snow. I sleep a shallow sleep, and in a dream a little boy runs toward the checkpoint, a white flag in his hand. Thread my coat to yours, and can we turn and turn and turn? Can I stitch your sadness to the wind and let it go? Will you build a little cabin on your little piece of land? Will you curve your body against mine and let it rest? I learned the oneness of alone. I learned to call this motion home. Travel in, travel deep. Travel in, travel deep. Travel in, travel deep. Travel in, travel deep.
Live music from Meg Hutchinson on Open Air here on the Rhythm and News Service of JPR, streaming at ijpr.org. I'm Eric Thiel. Meg, you went to a school associated with Bard College, which is a school that has got a couple of famous musical alums, Walter Becker, Donald Fagen from Steely Dan, both associated with Bard College, although I don't think Donald Fagen graduated. And Nick Zinner from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs was at Bard. But I find it interesting that you, despite what you do now, you weren't in the music department at the school.
Yeah, not really. I was much more in the creative writing department, and I was fairly obsessed with poetry. But I was starting to play gigs out in local bars. You know, I kind of would call them dive bars now, but at the time it felt really famous to me. I was pretty psyched, you know, even though it was like Dart League night, you know, and the construction workers were throwing the darts over my head. So I was playing music, but I wasn't, at Simon's Rock, I didn't quite find the outlet for the kind of music I was writing. So ultimately, I put together a thesis committee of both musicians and writers and was able to do a songwriting senior thesis. But yeah, primarily I was focused on the writing.
And you said Simon's Rock, so that was a school under the umbrella of Bard
College?
Yeah,
it's actually now called Bard College at Simon's Rock.
Okay.
But it's a junior college, and it's much smaller than Bard, but you know, absolutely affiliated with it, and a great place.
So I don't remember if it was The Crossing back in, 2004, or if it was Come Up Full, but Performing Songwriting, Songwriter Magazine, wrote what is a quote that is sort of like a ton of bricks. They said, "You were a master of introspective ballads filled with understated yearning and exquisite sense of metaphor. Does that just overwhelm you? Like, how do you respond to something that flowery about what it is that you're doing?
You know, honestly, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to reviews. I have this kind of file where I put them, and sometimes I read them, and sometimes I just kind of hand them down the stream, you know, and maybe I'll go back to them in 3 years. But
scrapbook or something.
Yeah, I try not to be terribly influenced with what by what people are saying about a record. I like words like exquisite, and I like the understated yearning, because I think I do aim for that. You know, it's important, I think, to for me to strike a nerve, to be honest in my writing. I feel like that's the only chance I have for it to resonate with somebody else, if I can be write what I know, write what I feel moves me. But there's a fine line between that and being confessional, and that's something I'm constantly trying to keep in mind. So I like the understated part. I think that's a good mission.
You know, a lot of your music, a lot of your songs tend to start with sort of an evocation of a geographic location or some imagery, but then they kind of twist and they start to touch on societal issues. And it reminds me a little bit of how Jon Stewart approaches challenging subjects. He starts with humor and it disarms mm-hmm. people. And I get the same sense of that in your music, that you start by disarming people with this beautiful sound and these beautiful images, but then the knife starts to cut a little bit deeper.
Oh, no one's ever described it like that. I like that a lot.
Do you have that conception when you're putting together a record that you want to try to continue to make beautiful music, but you want there to be some deeper meaning behind the songs?
Yeah, I think there are a couple things I try to keep in mind. First, it helps to give people a sense of place and a sense of a picture. It's almost like creating a movie for me or a slideshow. I want to give people images that can make them enter the song in a personal way first. And then I try to use that as this lens through which I can suddenly broaden the scope of the song and suddenly give them a much bigger message. But I feel like it's a fine line in our work of not being preachy and not, you know, I have a lot of strong feelings about the war, about, you know, a lot of political views that I would like to voice in a bolder way, but I don't think that's a song people would want to hear more than once, you mm-hmm. know? So for me, it's how do I make this personal? How do I make it a song that actually is something you'd want to listen to many times? And maybe some of those bigger messages can sift through as poetry rather than as some kind of bold, harsh statement.
Meg Hutchinson is my guest live on Open Air here on the Rhythm and News Service of Jefferson Public Radio, in concert tonight at 7:30 in Jacksonville at Brit. Meg, you mentioned a moment ago Greg Brown, and I want to ask you about him. We'll take a quick break and then back with more with Meg Hutchinson. 30 seconds. Meg Hutchinson is my guest live on Open Air here on the Rhythm and News Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Meg, you mentioned one of your early influences, Greg Brown, and it's just got to be so satisfying now to be a recording artist for Red House Records, the label that Greg Brown founded.
It is, and it's no accident. I think that conditioning probably really shaped me into being an artist that would ultimately be a good fit for that label. So I think it was very early on that started to form me, people like John Gorka and Greg Brown, but it's a huge honor. I have the greatest respect for them, the integrity with which they operate, and the freedom they give artists to develop and not try to crank out hit songs, but to really grow over a whole lifetime.
I want to ask you about something that happened when you were younger, at age 11, right around age 11, your grandmother passed, and you ended up inheriting her guitar. She was a guitar teacher, right?
Yeah, she was living in Chico, California.
Yeah, which is not that far
from here. I just drove up through there yesterday.
Do you have family in the area?
I do, yeah. Oh, okay. My uncle is still there. He actually came out to my show in San Francisco, and he was the one that looked out for me. He took the guitar after she passed away and boxed it up and sent it to me, and I'd only been taking guitar lessons for maybe like 6 months, and I was really a little terrified of the guitar because it meant so much to the whole family. And it was, 57018 Martin.
Did your family do the kind of thing where you would gather around grandma and she'd play music for you?
You know, I didn't get to know her that well because I was living, you know, out on the East Coast. And I only flew back here once as a kid. And they came out to see us maybe 4 or 5 times. So for me, it's been more a way to get to know her after.
I remember reading her. Yeah, I remember reading somewhere or hearing somewhere in an interview you did that you said that you felt like the guitar held songs that your grandmother never got a chance to write.
I really do. I mean, she was raising 2 boys up in the hills of Cohasset and working, you know, odd jobs, packing almonds in a factory and whatever it took to get by and to support her husband, you know, who was this great writer. And so I feel like, you know, she was a really fiery, passionate, interesting woman. They called her Red. You know, she was feisty. And I think she had a lot of music and a lot of songs in her that didn't have a chance to come out. And so I try to honor that when I play her guitar. I try to listen for it.
Yeah, you feel like you might be helping her out finishing some of those songs, right?
Yeah, she's definitely helping me out. You know, it's been a good way to feel close to her because I didn't get to know her that well when I was little.
It's Meg Hutchinson live on Open Air here on Jefferson Public Radio. Can we hear another tune?
Sure. I'll play you one from Come Up Full. And this is called Seeing Stars. And this song has become this little miracle song. It's probably the easiest song for me to write ever. It just kind of hit me on a dog walk one night out around this beautiful reservoir with my dog. And it's around ultimately bringing in more royalties than any other song, which has been great. It's paid for my dog to withstand a few years of cancer and actually thrive. And it's very odd. I mean, I got a royalty check on the day that we learned that she was sick. And I feel like she wrote the song with me. So it's been a little miracle song. Bugs out on the water, make it look like rain. Leaves on every tree, once again turning. Summer's past, but it's never far. If you look real close, you might see scars, but me. Yeah, me, I'm only seeing stars. Evening light on a gravel path. I could be scared, but I've had enough of that. Old big old moon rising up. Even in this light, you might see scars, but me. Yeah, me, I'm only seeing stars. And they take everything. Got nothing left, a deer in the headlights in your hospital bed, just dreaming of a simple life, a gentleman, a solid night, me and the dog down at the reservoir. If you look real close, you might see scars, but me. Yeah, me, I'm only seeing stars. Oh, 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 oh. Seems all your songs are about leaving. Seems both your hands are about now. Up in the sky, home through the dark. If you look real close, you might see scars, but me. Yeah, me, I'm only seeing stars. Me. Yeah, me, I'm only seeing stars.
It's Meg Hutchinson live on Open Air on Jefferson Public Radio's Rhythm and News Service online at ijpr.org. Great song. Thanks, Meg.
Thank you.
You once worked at an organic lettuce farm?
I did. I actually worked on a farm all through college, and it was not glamorous work. It was kind of
really
like,
that's shocking.
It was like glorified factory work in the most beautiful setting imaginable. Huh. And I really did cut lettuce for like 5 hours a day, and then wash it in these big tanks and drive it off to farmers markets. And but there's something about having my hands in the dirt every day that kept me really grounded. And you know, I'm such a country kid anyway that I actually really valued that time.
Well, at a certain point, the country kid packs up and moves to the big city, right? You sort of move to the mecca of singer-songwriter world, which is Boston, and you ended up where a lot of successful and many unsuccessful singer-songwriters end up, which is the subway system in Boston.
Yeah, it was a very strange dream to have. I actually really wanted to play the subway, and that's one of the reasons I moved to Boston. And I'd heard that Tracy Chapman had been discovered there, and I'd heard that John Mayer had played there, and Martin Sexton, and so I did. I moved there in 2002 and played the subway for like a year and a half, and it was a brutally honest performing environment, and I actually learned a lot from it and enjoyed it, and people would, you know, people that knew me, every now and then I'd like see someone that I had gone to school with or something, and they would look really worried about me, like, oh my gosh, she must be, you know, homeless or something. But
did you dress in like a performance outfit or just like sweats and a
no
hoodie?
I didn't want to be terribly conspicuous. I mean, yeah. I wanted my voice to stand out, but I didn't want to be, you know, too dolled up. Not that that's my thing anyway, but
we'll get pictures on Facebook, you'll see her.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of want to be a little careful down there, especially if you're playing late at night. I mean, you don't want to stand out as you know. So I'd wear a big bulky sweater. It was pretty cold a lot of the time down there too, so you know, sometimes I'd play with gloves with the fingers cut off the end,
and warming them over a fire pit right in between. So What is that process like of playing the subways? Do you approach it from the sense of this is a woodshedding experience for me, just to get experience playing in front of people, or do some people actually make a bit from performing in the subway system?
That's the only way I was living. So yeah. I was making enough from CD sales and tips at that moment, you know, right before everything changed with people plugged into their iPods.
Yeah.
I kind of got the last little moment where people were still paying attention, and you could make really good money in a 4-hour period before you lost your voice down there.
And that whole scene is starting to go away now, right? You mentioned the iPod thing.
It's really shifted. I feel like it changed around 2004, right as I was phasing out my busking era. It really became a very different environment where everybody's walking around with, you know, plugged into their own soundtrack, and they're not listening anymore. And I've talked to people that are still busking, and they just don't make any money, which is sad. It was a really beautiful tradition, I think, in the city. And it's fun to kind of hear the sounds of a city. And I think that's changing.
Yeah. Well, that's one of that's always been for me and for a lot of us that work in this business. One of the things that we've always appreciated about music on the radio is that this is a shared space. You know, yeah, you can be in your car, or you can be at work, or you can be at home, or in, you know, doing errands in the yard. But it is a shared space where we're all collectively connected to music and to news and to stories here on radio. That's why a lot of us get into it too. So it's sort of sad to hear that entire venue or avenue of learning the craft is kind of going away because everybody's just plugged into their own singular universe.
Yeah, it's strange. We are getting very isolated, you know, with all these gadgets and the ability to totally tune into our own private world. It changes the social fabric, I think, you know, and it changes those cool little interactions that happen between strangers.
Yeah. You know, you have so many accolades as a songwriter, from Kerrville and the Lennon competition. Do you write songs always with yourself in mind as the performer, or do you sometimes envision other people singing the songs as you're writing them?
I actually don't very often picture someone covering my songs, but I do try to write beyond myself. And I think increasingly, like the recent record, The Living Side, is one where I feel like I'm suddenly kind of moving beyond this exploration of myself to trying to look again at a bigger picture and trying to look at other people's stories. And I think it's really common, you know, in your 20s that you're kind of obsessed with your own identity and figure out who you are. And then I think there's this new impulse to use creativity to then try to move beyond that a little bit. So, but yeah, I don't really picture people covering them yet, although I know some people do. I see some stuff on YouTube, and it's interesting to hear someone else do it.
You'd be okay if somebody like Greg Brown or John Gorka called and said, you know, Meg, really, really want to do one of your songs.
Yeah, that'd be fine with me.
Have you ever heard a cover that somebody's done that you really liked?
Not yet. But, you know, it's possible it exists, and I just haven't heard it recorded.
You know, earlier you mentioned politics in music. And I remember a number of years back, I think it was John Mayer, coined the term light green in terms of environmental activism, where he just said, you know, not everybody has to be uber green. You can just sort of be light green. You know, you just have to think about the choices that you make. And I get a little bit of that sense in your music in terms of its politics, whether it's talking about, you know, environmental concerns or political concerns, that rather than it sounding like you're encouraging people to act upon something, you're kind of putting an issue out there and just saying, think about it. You know, do you kind of want your music to move the needle?
I think change happens with a strong feeling first. So maybe what I aim for is to create that impulse for change, or that feeling in someone, rather than that call to action. And I think I leave the call to action up to to somebody else. But I think it starts with it. If you feel moved by something, and if something strikes you on a very personal level, then you go out and think about how to be an activist. And I feel like that's how the only way I could write about the war was to write about Jeffrey Lucy, this one soldier, you know, who came home with terrible post-traumatic. And that's a story that for me was the best way to write an anti-war song, is to say, look at what happens to our kids when they come back. And that's a song that I hoped would speak to people that supported the war, you know, as well as people that were against it. And it's a human story. And so I think that's what I aim for, is how do we make this real in our own lives? And then we can go out and actually try to do something to change it.
Meg Hutchinson is my guest live on Open Air on the Rhythm and News Service of JPR. In concert tonight, 7:30 up on the stage at Brit, a special off-season show, and the audience up on stage as well. Can we hear another tune?
Sure. I think I'll play Gatekeeper here. This is an example, I think, of what we were just talking about, trying to make a bigger issue personal again. And I dedicate this to a guy named Kevin Briggs, who patrols the Golden Gate Bridge and has saved 200 lives by asking two questions of people that are about to jump. He asks, how are you feeling and what are your plans for tomorrow? And I think that's really bold and really inspiring, that these really ordinary questions are the things that can save people. So it's called Gatekeeper. When the day is grown too long, the hours standing still, you wonder if you could, if you will. With your toes upon the edge, with your eyes upon the sky, tell me just these things before you fly. Tomorrow, will you let me make some? And after, you can do as you will. If your hand should lose the rain, heel should lose the cord, well, everything seemed fixable that did not before. How the sun shines on the bay, the islands over there, you'd make it through today if you dare. How are you feeling? What are your plans for tomorrow? Will you let me make some? And after, you can do as you will. Maybe every day, in ordinary ways, we hold each other on, keep each other hero. Maybe every day, in ordinary ways, we hold each other on, keep each other here.
It's Meg Hutchinson live on Open Air on the Rhythm and News Service of Jefferson Public Radio in concert tonight in Jacksonville at Brit at 7:30. Tickets and information on the show at britfest.org. Meg, you mentioned just before you performed there that a lot of your songs are human stories of other people and things that you come across. There are also songs in your repertoire that are intensely personal stories, and I want to ask you about one. It's called At First It Was Fun. And in fact, the title of your newest album, The Living Side, comes from a lyric in that song. It's a nod to the Icarus myth. I don't know if you're going to play it, but it's a nod to the Icarus myth of flying too high and crashing down. But it's a lot more than that for you, and I wonder if you'd share that story.
Yeah, so that song for me is exploring the intoxication of the higher end of the bipolar spectrum. And something, you know, that I have experienced myself. And there's a moment, I think, when you feel like you really are leading the whole band. You feel like the lights really are shining for you, and you can fly that close to the sun without the wax melting off your feathers, you know. And then there's a really harsh wake-up call when you realize that there's a long way to fall once you're up next to the sun like that. So that theme is woven throughout this record. And I feel like I explore the other end of that a lot on the record as well, the lower side. But that song, At First It Was Fun, is kind of saying I wouldn't trade it in. You know, I wouldn't change this chance I've had to maybe have more colors in the palette, you know, lighter lights and darker darks. And maybe that's fed me as an artist, even though I don't think it's necessary to good art to have to suffer and be tormented. I don't think you have to be mentally ill to be a good artist, but that's the lot I've been given. And I feel like at the same time that I was given those challenges, I was also given maybe all the tools I needed to survive it and cope with it. And I feel like that's what the songwriting has been, this medicine in my life that I discovered before I knew what my illness was. They've kind of gone hand in hand. And so, yeah, At First It Was Fun has this almost broken circus feel to it, of kind of a waltz gone slightly wrong, you know.
And this was significant for you, right? I mean, this goes back quite a few years and got very serious for some time.
Yeah, 4 years ago was the ultimate low. And I think the records, you know, Come Up Full and The Living Side have been a process, a journey back from that and a way through that towards healing and then towards something. I think first you kind of regain your sense of yourself. And then I think you start, for me, I start trying to move then beyond myself a little bit in this process. And certainly I think the experience, anytime we experience suffering, whether it's mental anguish or physical suffering, I think it kind of opens a new window for compassion in your life that you may not have had prior. And I think things came very easily to me in my early life, and school went well, and I had a great family, and I was a really happy, hopeful kid. So when this other stuff hit me, it was humbling, and it really kind of, you know, took the rug right out from under me. But it's also given me a window into kind of the nobility of the human spirit. You know, I look around at everybody else now and realize how brave people are. And maybe I wouldn't have understood that as well if I hadn't gone through this experience. So, yeah, it's informed a lot of this material on the living side. And it's also, you know, chose that title as a way to say, you know, this is what I'm choosing to look at, is the hopeful side when you come through that, and the living side, and how to take something really dark and really difficult and try to transform it into something else.
I find it kind of cruelly ironic that you have ended up sort of choosing a career where some of the triggers for bipolar disorder are embedded in there. You know, it's sort of an employment line that is fraught with successes and failures. And you mentioned one of the other triggers that was part of this was an irregular schedule of traveling from time zone to time zone. That seems to be what you do all the time.
Yes, you are very astute.
Right?
It is not the recommended lifestyle for someone dealing with chemical imbalance.
Yeah.
That being said, as I mentioned before, it's also my medicine. So on a day where I'm traveling all day and getting up at night and playing a song, ultimately, the songs anchor me. So the travel is really taxing in ways, and the time zone is crazy. And I'm out here, and then I'm going home, and then I'm going directly to Europe for, you know, a 2-week tour over there in December, and that can really mess with you, even if you're not already dealing with some issues. But at the same time, the music is kind of like an old friend at the end of every day, and it keeps me grounded. And you know, there's just there are the added challenges of the crazy sleep schedule and all that, but I wouldn't change it. The music is kind of makes up for that in my life.
With the treatment and diagnosis, do you feel like the last few years your songwriting has sharpened or changed in some way?
I think for years before I knew, I was kind of shadow boxing with it. I didn't really know what I was up against, but the music, you know, I think when you're creating something, you tend to tap into a very subconscious place. And I think my songs, even on the crossing, you know, prior to knowing what I was up against, the songs really talk about it. And they created this kind of map for me to use once I really needed it. You know, the songs on the crossing came to help me later. But I feel like the two records since have been a more conscious exploration of it and kind of owning it and saying, you know, this is what I'm dealing with. But it's also, you know, it's a means of recovering. And I don't think, you know, something that upsets me in this country, particularly surrounding mental health care, is that we tend to look at treating a symptom with one small pill or 20. They tend to overdo it without looking at the bigger picture. And I think there's a place for all of these things in any kind of recovery, but you have to be treating the whole person. You have to be treating their spirit. You know, you can't just be dealing with the symptom. You have to look really deeply at kind of the root cause. And I feel like my experience has been a vehicle for spiritual growth and change too. You have to really look deeply to change some of those things. So I would encourage a change in how we view our care in this country.
Yeah, well, you've channeled all of that experience into a really beautiful direction for us on your albums. I thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Do we have time for one last song?
Sure, I'll leave you with a little summer waltz. It's a simple love song. In the midst of all these other complicated songs on the record, I figure just a nice, easy love song for you. I know that you're only gone a few short days. They'll pack you up and stand there and I wave. Then drive off into bright summer evening heat, city shining. And if you could see me now, I am turning to tell you something. smiling all the way home. Oh, oh darling. Mm-hmm. Oh. I've never been one to mind being alone. Don't get me wrong, none of that's really changed. It's just that I've noticed everything tastes, looks, feels a little better when you're around me. Oh, and if you could see me now, I am turning to tell you something. Oh, and if you could see me now, I am smiling all the way home. Oh. They say that everything changes. Oh, is it true that one day we'll be ashes to ashes? Oh, oh babe, I'll be singing. Oh, and if you can see me, I'll be turning to tell you something. Oh, and if you can see me then, I'll be smiling all the way home. Oh, oh, darling. Mm-hmm. Oh.
It's Meg Hutchinson live on Open Air on the Rhythm and News Service of JPR. The new album is called The Living Side, out on Red House Records. Meg will be live in concert tonight at 7:30 in Jacksonville at Brit. Britfest.org is the website for more information. Meg, thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
Craig Shank continues Open Air in just a moment here on Jefferson Public Radio.
Sorry I didn't play it first. It was fun. It's in a different tuning, and I was
okay.
Oh, I don't know if I can go there. It would have been great to play it right after that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for the great questions.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
It's always nice to, like, dig in a little more. Than the... So what comes first, the music or the
Yeah. Oh, that was great. I'm going to be out at the show tonight.
Oh, good.
Yeah. In fact, awesome. One of the things I didn't even get to ask you a little bit about is that whole Winter Bloom project. Because we've had Antje in here.
Oh, good.
And it looks like in February, I might be putting on a concert with Natalia.
Really?
The woman that I date is a restaurant owner here in town. And Ashland itself is a really horrible place for music.
Is it?
Because there's no music venue.
I played at the UU Church, that concert series they do here.
The Unitarian Fellowship?
Or? I think it was at a UU Church. It was a big church. I opened for Laura Love here.
Okay. Yeah, that might have been it. Ariella St. Clair, does that sound familiar?
Yes.
St. Clair, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she puts on a series, and it's sort of hit or miss. I mean, it's really sort of hit or miss. Peter Mulvey just did it, did that venue, 40 people maybe. Mm. There was a club in Ashland called Stillwater that had opened up a couple of years ago, but it was run by, and the thing was oriented really weird so that the performance space was at the end of the thing, and it had like a long bar that cut into the room. So unless you were at the front, it was like a long, narrow column. It was bad. And it wasn't run well enough, and it went out of business. So we have a couple of little restaurant bar places that will bring in either like a regional blues group, 3 or 4-piece blues group, or a songwriter, Stephanie Schneiderman comes down from Portland, and Tony Furtado comes down from Portland. But that's about it. So I've been talking with her and her ex-husband, who's the co-owner. They've got a main room in their restaurant that they say will fit between 50 and 70, which is not bad.
Yeah.
And their bar is actually through an archway into another area, so you don't have all of that clinkety-clinkety crap
going
on.
Right, all that traffic, yeah.
And they've got a sound system in there already because they turn themselves into a nightclub late at night. And so they're willing to try it out. And so it looks like we're going to try in February Natalia Zuckerman and Garrison Starr. They're traveling together.
Yeah.
And just see if it works.
It seems like a town that supports music. You just don't have a venue, right? I mean, it seems like such a alternative, cool.
And we've got a college of 6,000 people, but it's not that big, you know?
Yeah.
It's just kind of a weird place.
So there's nothing on campus that's surprising.
Completely dead.
Yeah, weird.
The station, we used to do two concert series. One of them was called One World, and it was world music performers. Yusu Indoor and Habib Kwate and stuff like that. And then we used to do a series called Vox Pop, which back in the day was Greg Brown, Sean Colvin,
wow.
John Gorka. But both of those series required a bit of